So we continue with the series on Sanatana Dharma. Namaste. Last time we spoke about the avatar. And one of the things that the Gita says so beautifully, that when a man has no desires, he is not driven by the ego, then why does he work? Why would he work? Because normally we are driven by either some personal ambition, some personal motives, selfish motives, desires. So why would such a person work? And the Gita gives a very beautiful answer. Sarva bhuta hite rataha and lok sangrahart. He is ever engaged in the good of all creatures, which is not just the good of all mankind. Sarva bhuta hite rataha. And the second is lok sangrahart, carrying the march of mankind forward and upward. So this is a very cryptic hint, but a very important hint that man's has not just an individual dimension but a collective one. In fact, the collective dimension starts even before man. There are groups of animals, elephants, wolves, dogs, lions, who tend to come in groups. As there is a growth of consciousness, even in the higher animals, there is a tendency to come together in a purposeful action. Even there is a linking of emotions, there is a sympathy, etc., which manifests in various kinds of behaviors. So there is a collective dimension, and very often when we talk about spirituality, especially because of the overstress on nirvana and moksha, we have forgotten that there is a collective dimension also. So there have been efforts to organize a whole society based on spiritual lines. So in India we have the conception of Ramarajya. And the biggest conception, the most deepest and profound conception is of Vasudev Kutumbakam. But most of the time we understand it very superficially. Superficially means that yes, all we should be good to everybody and everybody should be good to us. And there's a bonhomie and tolerance and let us accept each other. This is a very superficial way of looking at it. So Vasudev Kutumbakam or Ram Raj is not just about that. It is something much deeper and profounder, as we'll still see. And we must be aware of the utter seriousness and the vastness and scope of this ideal. So Vasudev Kutumbakam, for example, can never be created by purely outer means. It's just impossible. One may have everything right, the right king, everything. And that's one of the fallouts of the Ramayana story. It's interesting and strange and paradoxical that while we swear with the ideal of Ramraj, Ramraj is more ingrained in the common Indian psyche than Vasudev Kutumbakam, which is more like an abstract phrase. But the paradox is that in Ram Raj, jiske bare mein, you know, it is said, Dehik Devik Bhautik Tapa Ram Raj Kahuni Vyapa. There was no suffering of any level in the kingdom of Rama. And the reason, as we have discussed this earlier, that is because the burden or the onus of responsibility is taken by the leader. So the conception there is that the leader has to be of a kind. Based on the state of consciousness of the leader, the mankind, the rest of the people get affected. So this is what we see the mother also telling us, that whenever, you know, in a group there was a problem, she would call the captain and ask him, what was your state of consciousness? Or in a classroom when children would be very in a state of disarray, she would ask the teacher, what was your state? Were you in a state of complete control yourself? So if you are not, then children, you can't expect children to be in a state of control. This challenge is coming more and more now because of the COVID. Now there are digital classrooms. So there is no way you can control, except, it's very interesting, except if you are so engaging with the students that they really, really want to listen to you. And because of your own state of consciousness, you can transmit that to others. So this is one aspect. And yet in Ram Raj, we have the paradox that the Empress herself, someone as pure as, honorable as Mata Sita, she has to be banished into the forest. So Ram Raj remains as an ideal conception. And in the story of Rama, we have a hint, a very beautiful hint. When will Ram Raj come? When the divine soul, the soul within, and material nature, which Sita represents, they come together in a harmonious union. This is one place where the hint is so beautiful. So Sita has to go back. And what we see in the toward the latter half of the story of Ramayana is again very interesting. While on one side Lord Rama is conducting the kingdom in a very beautiful way, the most highest ideals of that age, when you are dealing with a more animal and rakshasic kind of humanity, he is conducting it according to Raj Dharma. But Mata Sita, the earth nature which is trying to aspire towards something higher, has to stay in ashramas. So there is a disparity between the two, and that we see that in ancient times in India, the way the balance was maintained was that there were the kings and administrators, and there were the rishis who used to guide them. So this was the closest it could come, that the rishis would guide the kings and then the kings would administer. Of course, there were some Raj Rishis, like the whole lineage of Janak. Janak is not one king, but a whole lineage of kings who were governing the kingdom. King Ashwapati himself, we see, is a great king. And there are beautiful stories about King Ashwapati, that even rishis would come to him to further their knowledge, a kind of knowledge which only those who engaged with worldly life could have in the right spirit. So there have been this ideal. But even there, we see that within the Hindu context, in Sanatan Dharma, there was such a detailed way of trying to organize an ideal society. For instance, they recognized, unlike many other, in other religions also there is the ideal, oversimplistic. Let's take quickly some examples. For example, we have the Ummah in Islam. What is it? Brotherhood. So many people are drawn, the ideal of brotherhood. But it's the brotherhood only of Muslims. What about others? So you know what happens to that ideal. So others have to be converted. Then only there can be a universal brotherhood. So from there the tendency starts, either convert or be banished. And it's the tendency to create the same type, to create brotherhood. Now this is nothing else but the projection of the ego self onto everybody else. Everybody must think like me, believe like me, be like me. Then only we can be brothers. Now that way, if we see a rational democratic society is better, it accepts that there can be differences, which comes closer to the Sanatan Dharma. In Sanatan Dharma, we have variety of approaches. It doesn't matter. Vasudev Kutumbakam is not only for the followers of the Gita or believers in Krishna. It is a much vaster ideal than the Ummah of Islam or the brotherhood of Christians. You know, it was a very strange at one point of time, the brotherhood of the Christians. They were actually persecuting the Inquisitions. We know what used to happen. And there is a very barbaric kind of meditation where the saints would meditate and take joy in the suffering of those who have been punished. How can you? So look at the consciousness, that the reason was a little different. The reason was, they are suffering and I am safe. It was not happy at the suffering of somebody, but it is as worse. How can you be happy as long as one single soul is suffering? You see, it's just not possible. So this was one of the ideal. A greater ideal was a Buddhist ideal. In Buddhist ideal, though there is a line of Buddhism which went towards Nirvana, which is the Hinayana Buddhism, the Buddhism of the South, which stripped everything out of existence and focused only on the banishment of what? Question mark. Because there is no soul, but of something in a state of Nirvana. But the Mahayana accepts the whole world. And it deals with the world with the state of compassion and piety. So there was another way of manifesting this ideal, that those who have arrived at a certain state of consciousness, they must come back and help mankind. And they must help with the state of compassion and piety. So we see something in Buddhism. We see very similar teaching in Christ. Sri Aurobindo goes on to say, almost he is certifying what has later on come out, that possibly Christ came to India. There are a lot of books written on that. And he learnt various different kinds of yogas, but was deeply influenced by Buddhist yoga. If you see that time, the Kashmir Valley was a hub of all kinds of yogic practices. And Sri Aurobindo says, Buddha speaking through the lips of Christ to the Western audience. So it's like he carried the message of compassion and piety. So this was one way, that there will be souls who are at one level, and they must help others with compassion. But compassion is wonderful for an individual. But is compassion powerful enough to change the nature of mankind? No. Compassion can save a few. Shobindu speaks, when he speaks about the three kinds of laws which operate, or three kinds of, you know, uplifting energies which operate in the world. He says there is the law of karma, that is one. So law of karma is also an evolving law. It's a law of evolution in ordinary life. So as is your karma, you grow, you learn, you grow, you learn, you grow. It's a very slow process. Then there is compassion. The compassion is, there is the power that leans and picks up a few. The net remains as it is. But there are some who are lifted out of the net and they change. Like Bilva Mangal's story, Saint Augustine, Jagai and Madhai, Angulimal. So these are stories where the compassion has lifted a few out and they are saved. And the highest is grace. Now grace can annul karma, grace can even change this whole net. And that's where Shobindu's whole effort has been. But when we look at this, there is a division of humanity into two layers. One is those who have arrived at high state, the masters. And there are other, or adepts, or, you know, people with higher states of consciousness, and those who are in the lower state. But still the effort is to rescue them out of this net of darkness and ignorance. So this will remain what it is. Now obviously, though Buddhist way of organizing society is a little better, yet in the end, it leaves the whole field of manifold activities of life just the same. Then there was another attempt which Shobindu speaks very highly of. He says it was the last of the efforts at creating a spiritualized society, and that was the Khalsa. Now, unfortunately, again, that has gone down with the ideal of Raj Karega Khalsa. It's become like almost, and I have often wondered that why are the Sikhs having such a good sense of bonhomie with Muslims? They were the martial people who were meant to protect the Hindus against the Islamic invaders. And then I realized that when you wrestle, my own understanding is that when you wrestle too much with a person and embrace even as a wrestler, you tend to imbibe the qualities. So this idea of a separate Khalistan and separate Khalsa Raj, of course, one can understand from the network of forces. But this is not what it was meant. It was an effort at creating a spiritualized society. And we know that Guru Nanak Dev gave very simple methods. And one of them was that you do the karma always and you share with everybody whatever you get. What was that one chak and you share with everybody. So even now you will see it's only remnant that has remained. All others have gone. But the remnant that has remained is that if you go to any Sikh Gurudwara, you have something called as langar. So langar is something which anybody can join. Nobody asks you what caste you are, where you are coming from, what are your beliefs. And good food, it's guess. You have to, everybody sits on the floor. And you may be a big man or a small man, and you are given any amount that you want to eat, and no money is charged. It's a very nice thing. But it is only this much remains. All as other aspects have gone away. Because the real change that must come from within. First, you must be a Sikh to practice this. And Sikh means, literally it is a distortion of the word Sishya. You are the Sishya of the Lord. You are the disciple of the great master. Now all that has gone away, but it was an attempt, whatever it be, to create a spiritualized society. Shobindu has testified to that. There were various ways and means people tried to create it by marriage within the same social fabric, etc., etc. But nowhere we see the kind of magnitude and vastness of the attempt as in Sanatan Dharma. If we go in far back times, people recognize that no, you can't build a spiritualized society on the basis of uniformity. It's just not possible. It is contrary to human nature. So they understood the hierarchy. So how they understood hierarchy? So beautifully, we have the fourfold, the four varnas. So we have the different hierarchy of people. The Shudra, the Vaishya, the Kshatriya and the Brahmin, and each of them had a different kind of function, a different kind of duty, and by performing that they could find their own path. So it was a very complex order that it broke down later because time spirit had to break it and it became rigid, narrow, outwardly based is a different story. but it was based on a very profound spiritual experience and truth of the Purusha from whom all the beings, different category of beings have emerged. So it was based on that, that the Brahmin emerged from the head and the Kshatriya from the chest and the Bhuja, the Vaishya from the loins and the abdomen and Shudra from the feet. But all belong to the one Lord. So in that order, the system was that there is the regardless of the hierarchy, the oneness of the Lord. So in essence, we are all one. But then in manifestation, there is a difference. Why? Because in manifestation, there is a hierarchy. So the principle behind it was that the soul moves from a purely identification with the physical consciousness. So that's the Shudrahood. So Shudrahood is when I can understand most tangible physical things. In large masses of mankind are like that. They can understand only, you know, very often people ask in Shrubindu Yoga, tell us a method, tell us a method. So you say aspiration, rejection, surrender. No, but what we have to do? So you say, you have to do this, is the triple labor. But what I have to do means, how do you sit? What exactly you do? Because this is the tangible thing. This is how humanity understands. Then we see that in the vital humanity, you have these two ranges. One is a humanity which is still on harbor, you know, around the lower ranges of the vital. And there is another humanity which is on the higher ranges of the vital, the Vaishya and the Kshatriya. And then the mentalized humanity, which is the Brahmin. And then going beyond a spiritual human being who is free from these. So they realize that the soul evolves through this fourfold process, from below upward. And in Hinduism, it was easy to understand it because this is the idea of rebirth. If there is no rebirth, there is nothing like a hierarchical revolution. So if we don't accept the idea of rebirth, then the idea of spiritualized society is a non-starter. So because there was the idea of rebirth, there was evolution. So all this was taken into consideration. Then again, there is the problem of gender equality. So how did the Sanatana Dharma create again there a spiritualized society? What should be the relation between a man and a woman? So there again, it was based on the principle that there is something like a masculine element in nature and something like a feminine element in nature. So what is the masculine element in nature? It is ideative, intellectual. You see, men were compared as sky, heavens, and women were considered as earth. Now you see, it's a very interesting combination. When you see, it's not about lower and higher. What is heaven? What is the sky? Sky is something more neutral. It is high above. What does the sky pour upon earth? It pours rain and it pours light. These are the two functions of the sky. Rain, water and light. This is how it comes. That's all. So light is idea forces. And rain, water is that tendency to purify, that love which should reign. It makes the earth supple. What does the earth do? It receives these two things, but it breaks out into many folded colors and senses and seasons and everything else. Everything is organized by the earth. And if you ask between the sun and the earth, who is the doer? So earth will say it is all because of the sun. And sun, see, it's because of the earth. See, that is the ideal relation. And in ancient Indian thought, if you see that way long back, that there was this understanding that women can be great organizers, administrators, they can be in any field. But again, this idea got distorted into hierarchy, especially when we turn towards, exclusively towards the Purusha aspect, that is Vedanta. So the whole thing was man is superior. Why? Because he is heaven. It was not about superiority. The meeting of a man and woman of heaven and earth was that there is the ideative intellectual aspect which is more masculine, more strangely passive in one sense. And there is the dynamic, vital, intuitive, emotional being which is more feminine. And these two, when they meet together, they create completeness and perfection. So there was the balance between man and a woman. Then again, in ancient Sanatana Dharma, since they also recognized that man must go through different aspects of his growth. So unlike we see, unlike in, you know, and this is important to understand because very often people say, oh, look at it, you know, Sanatana Dharma is so complex, it's so easy. In Islam and Christianity, we are all Christians or Muslims. No, it's contrary to real things of human nature. So what happens when you give such an ideal? You see what has happened in the entire Christian world. You have the ideal of compassion and forgiveness, and then you invade every possible country upon earth. Because it's not consistent with human nature. There is the Kshatriya aspect. You have to go through these things. Or you create a division where you, on Sundays you go to church and then, you know, rest of the days you lead your life whatever way you want. So, but in Indian thought, all four were valid goals. Dharma, Earth, Kama and Moksha. So you have, but the basis is Dharma. You can't, that is fundamental. You may enjoy life, you may have your pleasures, whatever, money, wealth, but on the basis of Dharma. And we have spoken about Dharma, it's a very subtle and complex thing. Gahano Karmani Gati. So there was the basis of Dharma on which you had the valid goals, you could. But also there was, these goals were also hierarchically arranged. So when on the basis of Dharma you lead a life, so you have first the Brahmacharya Ashram where the basis of Dharma is taught to us. And then you have the Grahastha Ashram where you expand. Grahastha, literally it means to hold. So you hold property, you hold various things, you hold all. Grahastha, graha. One place, you know, Sri Aurobindo says this idea of Grahastha is so different. In, I think early days when he has come to Pondicherry, this before the mother's coming, somebody writes a letter to him that, you know, you come and tell us about spiritual life and we are ready to listen, but come and lead the country. He says, you see, I am practicing a yoga which none of you will understand right now. And then he goes on to say, I am practicing yoga as a householder. Now, Aurobindo, we know that never led a married life, and yet he speaks of householder. Now, what is the householder aspect? Literally, he has a house, he has. So, and he's engaged with the many aspects of work. He said, it's difficult for me at this point of time to even explain what is the kind of yoga that I am developing or is developing within me. The 10 limbs of the yoga has been given to me by none else but Sri Krishna, by the master. And it's, you know, moving along those lines. So when we look at the way the Sanatan Dharma Society was organized, it is so fantastic because it takes into account the entire range of complexity of human nature. Other day somebody was asking me just few days back, sir, what was sati? Now see, again, because we have been understanding all these things based on what, you know, Lord Curzon wrote or Hastings wrote. So sati is somebody who used to burn in the fire, isn't it? When the husband died, this is all we understood. Did Anusuya, Arundhati, did they really burn in fire when their husbands died? That's not sati. Sati is steadfast and sincere and one-pointed in love. So whoever is steadfast and sincere in love, this mother's definition when she saw the story of Anusuya. And look at the names. Anusuya, without jealousy. Arundhati, one who marshals the rays. Arundhati, she holds, receives the rays. And she's the one who receives the effulgence of the sun. So even the name, these are the two great satis. Draupadi, Tara, Mandodari, name. And you know, they were all regarded as satis because they were steadfast in love. So what a way that you don't have to go to temple, you don't even have to pray to a god, but just because you love a human being with utter one-pointedness, even if he's an asura, you can realize the divine. And this was asked to mother. She said, yes, because the psychic being is within us and the divine is in all. So if you really love like that, you can touch that core. And then Sri Aurobindo, of course, said his famous ki, only women can give themselves like that. So people may ask why there was no custom of sata. Why only sati? So he says, in reference to when mother, when she came and bowed before Sri Aurobindo, he says that first time, when he was asked, what did you see? He says, for the first time I saw complete surrender from the highest to the cells of the body take form, murtrup. And then I knew the time for divine life has come upon earth. And of course, the other thing he mentioned about the mother is that she is born free. But Sri Aurobindo says something very interesting. He added after that, perhaps only women are capable of such self-giving. So, women were satis was a qualification and not a disqualification. Men were not capable of loving like that. Look at this. And what we have received it now, oh, it was a horrible pratha and women were pushed into fire because we have mistaken Johar as Sati. Johar was a different custom. Johar, I have been to that place, I don't know if someone has traveled to Chittorgarh where we have the Rani Padmavati who jumped into fire along with, you know, all the queens, which was shown in that movie. Now this Johar was for a different reason because they were barbaric invaders who entered India and they would just plunder, loot, pick up, rape. This was their way of life. So women preferred their honor and dignity than their life. So they jumped into the fire. Then subsequently you see where is Sati most prominent? In Rajasthan areas. Ask anyway, ask in down south, do you practice Sati? No. Why in that area? Because this was the area most prone to invasions. So this Sati Pratha which came from Johar got mixed up with the original sense of Sati. Sati literally means steadfast in truth. So there were so many ways. You could worship a stone and realize the divine. You could love a man and realize the divine. Just imagine. You could pray to the sky and realize the divine. You could meditate inside and realize the divine. So the whole social system was, there was an attempt to really move in that direction. So why did it fail? There were two, three reasons. One is because it was inherently very complex. Human beings, this was the other challenge. Because when there is something very complex, human beings who are not developed, they can't receive it. Second, to take care of that, they had those who would live this truth or at least rightly receive it and communicate. So that's why there was the, you know, elitism, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, they would practice, they had the adhikar, and the Shudras and Vaishya did not have the adhikar because the life that was needed to be lived, incidentally, if a Brahmin committed an error, he had to be fined several times more than if a Kshatriya or a Vaishya committed the same error because it was a life of penance and tapasya. So not everybody was ready. So they received the truths and they shared. And the Brahmin was never supposed to ask any money. So the conception of Guru Dakshina came that you have to give, society has to give, the king will support him. So it was a picture perfect. If you really look at, at least when I look at it, I just wonder that what did these forefathers conceive? I can't imagine even now somebody conceiving such a system. So why it failed? One, because you had to preserve a certain class of mankind that created divide. Now nature will not accept it. Everybody must rise and all the qualities must come in all. So nature has created, but it has lasted for centuries and millenniums. If you compare to the Islamic brotherhood, look at it. Christian brotherhood, look at it. Buddhist brotherhood confined to few monasteries. But the Sanatan Dharma right up to the previous century, in spite of all the degradation. So something amazing. This was one reason. Second, by leaning towards the side of Purusha, they forgot Shakti. So Tantra aspect was subordinated, though lip service was paid, that Tantra is also, you know. But it was like, even now, people, Tantra, hardly anybody knows that most of the temples and all these rituals we engage in are Tantric rituals. We have forgotten the Tantra aspect, but we have caught on to those rituals. Because Puja, Upasana is very much part of Tantra. Vedantin doesn't need it. The other day somebody had sent me a WhatsApp university thing on a Vedantin saying that, you know, do you think by going to Lord Rama's temple you can create all this? You have to discover inside. Yes, but that is one part of the truth. The other part of the truth is to manifest. So you have dance based on Nataraj, you have music, science, everything you will trace back to a Rishi. It's not about feeling proud or not proud. Yes, one should feel proud, but that, look at the real thing. It's not about a Rishi. You read Ayurveda. How did Ayurveda come? Bharadwaj Rishi with everybody sits together and prays to Indra to, because human beings are suffering. They are having short lifespan, which was about 180 years, by the way, short lifespan. And he says, they cannot really fulfill the joy and everything of life. So I need something. So Ayurveda was given to make human beings strong and vigorous and youthful so that they can engage into the dharma. Even rightful enjoyment was part of dharma. So that is how Ayurveda comes into existence. So when we understand the spirit behind it, everything connected to the divine, flowing into many, many channels, science, astronomy, astrology, material sciences, everywhere you can, you know, go back to the Rishi who is trying to receive some truths from above. So there was a picture perfect, and yet it fell down. And because there is something which is at the core. You may have everything perfect, organization. The rational democratic societies come close to something, except that they miss the spiritual basis. In India, we had the spiritual basis and yet we miss something fundamental. And that is that spiritual basis has to be lived by the force of realization of the individuals. You cannot give it as a system. It can work because there were people who were realizing and people who trusted, and then it worked. But when people start receiving it purely as a kind of, you know, I have belief, it doesn't work. You have to realize it. And that is where we see something which Sri Aurobindo speaks of, and we are going to read today. It's from Ishavasya Upanishad. As we know, this is a dialogue between Guru and a student, and the first six verses of Isha Upanishad are taken up, and one of the beautiful things. And Sri Aurobindo speaks about the Vasudev Kutumbakam. And yet he says, when he describes all this, that what this ideal is, we may never have a paradise on earth, but if it is ever to come, it will come not when all mankind are as brothers, for brothers jar and hate so much. So, you know, this idea of brotherhood of mankind. Brothers fight in the same. And he gives the example of joint family in Bengal. We have joint families, no, even now. And see brothers doing court case against brother. Even if they don't say, they are hating each other. So he says that this cannot come by that. For brothers jar and hate as much. And often more than mere friends or strangers. See, it's a strange thing. Brothers may have, you know, disharmony, but friends and strangers, because there is no expectation. The friendship is the ideal relation actually between human beings, is the future. Because friends, mother said so beautifully, who is a friend? Sri Aurobindo said, friend is the extension of yourself. But at a lesser level, but more practical and in certain sense more wide, the mother says, your best friend is he who loves you in the best part, but does not want you to be otherwise. He's not trying to change you. He loves you in the best part and leaves the rest. It's a very beautiful passage. It's there in Collected Works of the Mother. I think it used to be in volume 9. Unfortunately, in the newer edition, it's missing. I don't know why. But you can locate it if you go on to the Google search. Best friend. But when all mankind has realized that it is oneself. When mother was asked what is the way to realize human unity, she said by human beings discovering their origin. As simple as that. This effort has started, and see how much it was stifled. In Christian world, where does life begin? 5,000 years back. In the Islamic world, I know I was in communication with one lady devotee who had so beautifully turned to Mother, and Sri Aurobindo unfortunately died prematurely, just wanted to come to ashram, and few months before, I'm sure her soul would come. And she was trying to organize a conference in Karachi. She said, I want people to understand we are Vedic civilization. So I said, don't they talk about it here? No way. You can't talk that our roots are Vedic. Forget about, okay, you may practice whatever you want to practice, but roots. But when humanity connects with the roots, it feels that yes, why not? We have all sprung up from that common origin. Nor can that be until mankind has realized that all existence is oneself. For if in united humanity tyrannize over bird and beast and insect, look at it 100 years back, you will see a seed about corona also here. Look what Sri Aurobindo is saying carefully. Nor can that be the ideal world until mankind has realized that all existence is oneself. For if an united humanity tyrannize over bird and beast and insect, the atmosphere of pain, hatred and fear breathing up from the lower creation will infect and soil the purity of the upper. So clear. But he doesn't stop there. He goes further. The law of karma is inexorable, And whatever you deal out to others, even such shall be the effect on yourself, in this life or in another. Do you think that this strange thing will ever come about, that mankind in general will ever come to see in the dog and the vulture, nay, in the snake that bites and the scorpion that stings, their own self, that they will see unto death my brother and in destruction my sister? Nay, that they will know these things as themselves, sarva bhuteshu chatmanam. Look at it. And this Aurobindo, when he is writing, why does it carry a force? Because he realized it. You know that experience of Aurobindo, which he has actually embodied also in, partly in one of the poems, that a scorpion had bit him. This is in Calcutta. And when the scorpion bites him, Aurobindo is looking at it and converting that pain into ananda. Mother quotes this story of Sri Ramakrishna, where cobra bites him when he is deep in meditation. What does he say? Tato na vijugupsate. Doesn't shrink. He says, what, Mother Kali? Again here. Mother Kali? And we create all kinds of divisions, distinctions. Look at the oneness. And then he says, cautions that if mankind begins to, and there are religions where it is said that, well, lower animals, they are created for man's enjoyment. How can you have an ideal world based on this? So when it is said, sarva bhuteshu chatmanam, it is not about just human beings, one homie. It's about the whole creation, all existences. So the student asks, it does not seem possible. And Aurobindo, in the form of the guru, answers, it does not, and yet the impossible repeatedly happens. At any rate, if you must have an ideal of the far-off event to which humanity moves, cherish this. Don't be satisfied with half-hearted things. I keep giving this example. People come to ashram, Auroville, and they say, we thought we came to an ideal world. I said, who told you that it is a ready-made world? You have to deserve it. So even if it is an ideal world, still you have to do the mehnat, effort to realize that. If you don't realize it within, even in heaven, you will compete with Indra and say, this fellow is on throne. What have I done not to deserve it? You are in heaven. Then your eyes will fall on Kamadhenu. And you will say, what? Why is she there? What if I take it in my house? That is the story of Vasishtha and Sahasrarjun. Or when you see Kalpataru, you will say, how much I can pay to get this into my personal place? So you are in heaven. Everything is provided. Ideal communist society where all are given roti kapda makan. Not only that, you are given everything else, much more. But it won't work out because your nature is still asuric. Ravana had Sone ki Lanka, but we don't talk about Ravana Raj's ideal. We still speak about Ram Raj. Rama didn't have Sone ki. So this is where he says that if you have to cherish an ideal, cherish this. And then he cautions us. See, Atlantis fell down, Lanka is raised to ground, Troy, one of the reasons why Troy fell, Aurobindo says, because nature does not allow this, that one civilization will develop, one group, whereas the others remain underdeveloped. So what was happening in Greece that time? Troy was a very developed civilization. King Priam, what a noble king. If you look at the way he deals with his kingdom before the war, there are warriors and it's so amazing. And he asks at the end, after hearing everybody, he calls Helen and he asks only one question. Do you still love my boy? And she says, yes. He says, then we'll have war. War for love. What a noble ideal. I mean, far ahead of its times. Even it will put our, you know, that Mahabharata moment when Yudhishthira has put Draupadi at stake. It will put that to shame. Given the greatness of the king, noble king. Priam is a very noble king. When his son, you know, dies, Hector dies so nobly. And he is being, Achilles, the barbarian that time, who doesn't allow his funeral. He comes and literally pleads him. If you look at the Troy that of that age, amazing. But look at all around, all tribals, look at the way Achilles murders. I mean, he's a killing machine. The only person who comes out as somebody glorious is Odysseus. He's really a very noble person. And few others. Even Agamemnon. Because he wants to marry a girl, so he has snatched her away. Achilles says, if you have snatched away my woman, I am not going to fight. This is tribals. But Odysseus and his wife Penelope come out as somebody really noble. But Troy, if you see, developed civilization in thought, in culture, many things. And yet nature brings it down to ground. Why? Because you can't develop like having one, you know, this kind of capitalist society at another level where one group is all developed and others. Nor will bringing everything down to the least common decimal as communism would want will work. There is something else which is missing, and that's what Sri Aurobindo now reveals to us. Distrust all utopias that seek to destroy sin or scrape away part of the soil in which it grows while preserving intact the very roots of sin. There is a line in Savitri where he says about bliss. Bliss is the root of things. And he says, it grows on forbidden soil. In Islam, in Muslim countries, your hands will be cut if you steal. And all kinds of rules are there. But look at the kind of barbarism that prevails. Not in all Islamic countries, but there are, you know, the kind of barbarism, because it's all hidden behind. There are harems where all kinds of things happen. You can't just do anything. I know of a friend who actually was called by one of the emirs for a dinner. So he went with his wife, came back alone, and there's no evidence. There's nothing you can do. You can't do a cold case. Nobody will speak. Where did she vanish? All that he remembers is that she was asked that, okay, these people will sit and enjoy. You come to our Janan Khana. Vanished. Without a trace. When he got up, nice gift, so he wants to come along with her. Please call her. Who? My wife. Where? Because the royalty has taken a liking to her. This is not very far back times. This is the kind of state. But you want to create a utopia on this basis? No, because the surface you can scrape. You can wear burqa, but inside the seed is the same. So this is what he is telling us. So what is the soil? The roots of sin. Ahankar, born of ignorance and desire. This is where the root is. By no outward means can you really create a mighty civilization. You have to create from here. And that's what is beautiful about India. It started as the civilization which was the group of rishis who realized, and they were transmitting through many masters and disciples. There was no organized religion ever in India. Later on, because of the invasions, people tried, as the mother said, there were only masters and disciples. There were schools where later on schools of thought, but they were masters and disciples. So it was so beautiful. You had the ashramas where you could realize in different ways. For once ahankar is there, likes and dislikes are born. Raga dvesho, the primal couple of dualities, liking for what furthers the satisfaction of desire, dislike for what hinders it. And this was not only, I have given one example, but it is everywhere. Picking up what used to happen even among many Hindu kings, same thing. Pick up. Now in Christianity, they started a smart thing. So outwardly, you have to be very much in good manners. Sri Aurobindo speaks of that. And he has understood this, that Britishers want to look good. So this is their weakness, which he exploits so beautifully. So outwardly, you know, marriages are made in heaven. But inwardly, you do anything. As he says, night booths where vices are repaired. Which is how life developed. So you had whole place to express a whole side of nature. This is how the hypocrisy and division came up. Liking for what furthers the satisfaction of desire, dislike for what hinders it. So ancient times, if you see, it was much, much more bold and courageous that people said, no, well, I love and I marry much, much more. That no, I am married to one person, but you have a different kind of life where all your passions and dark impulses are being satisfied. The sense of possession, the sense of loss, attraction, repulsion, charm, repugnance, love, hatred, pity, cruelty, kindness, wrath, the infinite and eternal procession of the dualities, admit but one pair and all the others come tumbling in its wake. That's why mother said that, you know, as long as you live in liking and disliking, you are not ready for yogic life. She said, yes, there are affinities, and it's okay to understand affinities, but you should not act on the basis of affinities. Affinities are all right. There are some people with whom you gel better. It's perfectly fine. You will be closer to them and father. But when you start acting on that basis in real life, in real time, your likes and dislikes, then you create chaos. She says, but if you admit one pair, all the rest will come tumbling in. Admit but one, but the man who sees himself in all creatures cannot hate. He shrinks from none. He has neither repulsion nor fear. Tato na vijugupsate. Then he gives practical examples, so beautiful. Good for us to remember now. Don't come near, you are suffering from this problem. Look at what Shobindu is setting an example. Yonder leper whom all men shun, but shall I shun him? Who know that from this strange disguise the Brahman looks out with smiling eyes? This is what Christianity understood unwittingly. Piety. This is what we have the Anandavan, which Baba Amte started, and we know that he wrote to Sri Aurobindo asking his permission. He says, I want to start a home for lepers, and he was a multimillionaire. People are saying, why are you doing this? You give money, don't directly involve. What should I do? The whole society is against me. Sri Aurobindo wrote a letter and said, when you turn your back to the world will follow you. They will come behind you. This is exactly what happened. Yonder leper. This foeman who comes with a sword to pierce me through the heart. I look beyond the sharp threatening sword, beyond the scowling brow and eyes of hate, and I recognize the mask of myself. My rival's downfall is my own disgrace. I look at my enemy and see Krishna's face. And we have such stories. Rama is not hitting in the heart of Ravana. Why? Because he loves Janki. She is there. Shiva is not destroying Jalandhar. Why? Because in his heart is his wife, who is a great devotee of Lord Narayana. Look at this power of divine presence. Thereafter I shall neither fear the sword nor hate the bearer. O myself, who foolishly callest thyself mine enemy, how canst thou be my enemy unless I choose? Friend and enemy are but creations of the mind, that myriad working magician, that great dreamer and artist. But thou wilt divide me with thy sword, thou wilt slay me, pierce me with bullets, torture me with fire, blow me from the mouth of thy cannon, me thou canst not pierce. Oh, beautifully. For I am unslayable, unpierceable, indivisible, unburnable, immovable. So this can only come when we have realized the self. It cannot come just by a theoretical reading. How many times we may read the Gita? But in real life, unless we practice even half a sloka of just practicing equanimity, we cannot realize it. Or even nishkam karma. One small thing. This is. Thou canst but tear this dress of me, this food sheath or multiplied protoplasm which I wear. I am what I was before. Now you see how complete is this. If you stop at it, he will say, yes, yes, he's speaking of Gandhism. No. He's not speaking of Gandhism. Gandhism is falsehood. It's a hypocrisy where inwardly you sheath, you are angry. You are not seeing the one self in your enemy. You are full of likes and dislikes, but outwardly you are restraining. So what you are doing? You are releasing moral force, which is far more destructive and chaotic. It's not about non-violence of Gandhism, but non-violence born of Buddha and the great seers. But he goes further. What if you have to resist the arm? What should be your attitude? So he gives that also. I will not be angry with thee even. For who would trouble himself to be angry with a child because in its play or little childish wrath it has torn his dress? Look at the magnanimity. Aurobindo, when stones were thrown and the man is on deathbed and his wife comes pleading and mother goes to Aurobindo and says, Lord, he is on deathbed. And Aurobindo says, what? Death for a few stones? This is the kind of... So what he would do? Perhaps I valued the dress and would not so soon have parted with it. I will try then to save it, if I may, and even punish thee without anger, so that thou mayest not tear more dresses. Look at the completeness not. For if I cannot, well, it was but a cloth, and another can soon be had from the merchant. Nay, have I not already paid the purchase money? If we live a life which is noble and true, what is there to fear in death? And how beautifully that I... Maybe I'll stop you. You know, often I tell people when they say, you know, this happened with me, so... Anyways, I've taken in this attitude, you know, some crime, these internet crimes nowadays, no? So I asked them, have you reported to the police? No, no, what is the use? I said, no, it's not because of you. You can afford it. But you must report because that person will feel strengthened to do it against many more individuals. It's not about you. So this tendency of seeing me, oh, it's a small amount. It's okay, I can afford it. It's not about the amount. It's about the collective awareness that in a society there are criminals. And we are far from perfect, or the police themselves may be an accomplice. It's a different story. But we must start thinking along those lines. That's not about me. It's not just about me and my little house. It's about the larger good. And then he says to the judge, me will thou hang? When thou canst shake the sun from heaven or wrap up the skies like a garment, then shall power be given to thee to hang me. Like Krishna telling Duryodhana, you want to tie me up? Bring a rope which can tie the worlds. Who or what is this thou deemest will die by hanging? A bundle of animalcule? No more. This outward thou and I are but stage masks. Behind them is one who neither slayeth nor is slain. Mask called a judge. Play thou thy part. I have played mine. Aurobindo had realized all this. So when he writes, it's authentic. But when we would speak, why we are not carrying this force? Because we have never tried to really live it. But one moment of experience of this oneself in all things is enough to liberate us. That's what, you know, mass called a judge, play out thou thy part, I have played mine. This was the way in which battles were fought by the great noble warriors of the ancient Aryan race. Okay, we may be friends, but today we are on opposite side. Bhishma says, I have to play my part. Sorry, I know you are going to win. With Vasudeva on your side, who can defeat you? I will play my part. That is the kind of spirit, the yoga of Bhishma, the Karma Yoga. Aurobindo gives an example that what is the true Karma Yoga. He gives some examples. One of them is, he says, what Bhishma practiced, what Krishna practiced. So play out thy part. I have played mine. O son of the ancient yoga, realize thyself in all things. Fear nothing, loath nothing, dread none, hate none, but do thy part with strength and courage. So shall thou be what thou truly art. God in thy victory, God in thy defeat, God in thy very death and torture, God who will not be defeated and who cannot die. Shall God fear any? Shall he despair? Shall he tremble and shake? Nay, it's the insects that form thy body and brain which shake and tremble. Thou within them sittest looking with calm eyes at their pain and terror. for they are but shadows that dream of themselves as a reality. Realize the self in all creatures. Realize all creatures in the self. Then in the end, terror shall flee from thee in terror. Pain shall not touch thee, lest itself be tortured by thy touch. Death shall not dare to come near to thee, lest he be slain. Yasmin sarvani bhutani atmeva bhud vijanata tatra ko moha ka shoka ekatvam anupashyata. This is the height. The terror will be terrified. Death will not come near because death will be slain. See the story of Savitri. All the Yamduts run away. You see, we can't even go near Satyavan. Then death comes and says, please allow. This is fated. I can't help it. I am just doing my job. It's my job description. Please see my identity card. Savitri says, okay, you try. I'm going to come with you. This is the ancient Aryan spirit, the sage Mandavya, who says, who has created this law that for pricking a butterfly with a needle I have to suffer whole night on a bed of nails? I will go and ask Yama, how can you do it to me? This is the ancient Aryan, you know, discipline where Kala, Mahakal comes to Lord Rama, says, sir, your time is over, but it's up to you. But your Leela is over. I have just come to remind you. If you want to come, please come. And Rama smiles and says, okay. This is what is the ancient Sanatana Dharma. Its biggest thing on which it leans is that man not just carries God within himself. Man can become one with God. And I think if we understand just this much, then there is all the rest follows logically, naturally, inevitably, spontaneously. Namaste.